573-8227. That's
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host, editor, and assistant producer is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
March 5th primaries. So I received my mail-in ballot about a week ago. So if you have applied for a mail-in ballot and have not yet received it, check with your county clerk to see if there's a problem. As soon as you know who you'll be voting for, you can fill it out and mail it in. You don't have to wait for early voting to technically start. Make sure you put enough postage on. Early vote centers will be open starting Tuesday, February 20th through Friday, March 1st. And then Election Day voting centers will be open March 5th from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Sample ballots are now available for the primaries. You can go to What's On My Ballot at harrisvotes.com and enter your name or address to see all the contests and candidates that you're eligible to vote for. You can bring handwritten notes into the voting place with you. Just be sure you take them with you when you leave. I like to print out my sample ballot and mark that. It's just kind of easier. The deadline to apply for a mail-in ballot is February 23rd, and you can click on a link I've provided for the application or go to your county clerk for your mail-in ballot application. Remember, it takes at least 3 days for them to receive it. Harris County turned my application around pretty quickly, but don't bank on that. We do have a joint primary this year. I have an article from Off the Cuff, and Andrew has some information for you as well.
Yes, and remember that the March 5th primaries are for the Democratic and Republican parties only. The Green and Libertarian parties have nominating conventions at the local and state levels. To find a list of county parties and information on nominating conventions, visit txgreens.org or lptexas.org, and there are links on the blog post at thinkwingradio.com.
And remember, the Green and Libertarian parties come after the March 5th primary. So if you intend to participate, then you cannot vote in the March 5th primary. So you're going to have to decide that in advance.
Yeah.
Okay, we have a couple of PSAs to start off the show. The first one is from communityimpact.com. There are at least six events, there are six more events at least throughout Greater Houston that celebrate Black History Month. If you're looking for ways to celebrate Black History Month in Houston, these events are happening throughout the month of February within the greater Houston area. The article lists events that include opportunities for food, films, music, culture, history, and more. You can go directly to the article at communityimpact.com or click on the link at thinkwingradio.com on this blog post. It is noted in the story that their list is not comprehensive, so if you're interested, you might search the web to see what other events and celebrations of Black History Month may be available to you locally. Again, you can find this article at thinkwingradio.com and just click on this specific link if that's the information you're trying to get. The other one, in other community information, Harris County Pets to host five low-cost spay and neuter events throughout February. And this is from communityimpact.com. Harris County Pets will host low-cost spay and neuter events throughout February in observance of Spay and Neuter Awareness Month and Responsible Pet Owners Month. Boy, to follow that last story with this story. So the same month. Okay. In any case, this event is strictly for people living in unincorporated areas of Harris County. According to a February 1st news release, each of the events will provide spay and neuter surgeries for a total of 35 pets. Licensed veterinarians will conduct the surgeries at a cost of $25 per pet, which is a good deal. Low-cost spay and neuter events will be held at the Harris County Pets Resource Center located at 612 Canino Road, Houston, on Saturday, February 10th, Saturday the 17th, Tuesday the 20th, and Saturday the 24th. To receive a low-cost spay or neuter service, pet owners must call for an appointment at 281-999-3191. That's 281-999-3191. Walk-ins will not be accepted. Show proof of residency in an unincorporated part of Harris County, such as a driver's license or any other valid ID indicating current address. You can also, for those unable to sign up for spay and neuter events in February, there's a link provided with the article and on my blog to view a list of low-cost spay and neuter services offered by organizations throughout Harris County. There is some more information in the story about the health benefits to your pet as a result of spaying or neutering them, as well as benefits to the community in reducing the population of feral strays. Andrew's mom is very involved in rescue of dogs, strays, so she's not on the show. So he may have more to say about this opportunity. Andrew?
Yes, there are definitely a lot of stray dogs and cats in Houston and Harris County, more than local authorities can keep up with, the way that my mom tells it. See, she did get to have her say. Yeah. Every one of those strays leads a hard life and runs the risk of a sad death, either out in the wild or in a shelter, where they have to make room for more strays. Some get taken home or picked up by rescue groups, but a lot don't. That's not even to mention the damage that strays can do to local bird and small animal populations. Spaying or neutering your pets stops another dog or cat from going down this path, and that's why it's so important.
Our next story is also from CommunityImpact.com. Friendswood officials discuss city policy for short-term rentals. While short-term rental owners in Friendswood don't currently have to register or pay annual fees, city officials are discussing if that policy needs to change as the area attracts more visitors. On February 5th, Friendswood City Council discussed the possibility of changing its policy for short-term rentals within the city. The city currently has 10 short-term rentals. However, city officials think visitor interest in the area could grow in coming years, as evidenced by the development of the Great Wolf Lodge in Webster, which is slated for completion in November of 24. Per Texas law, Friendswood can tax short-term rentals through a hotel occupancy tax, which is 6% for the state and 7% for Friendswood, according to the presentation shown to council. To date, Friendswood has only documented a noise complaint and a parking violation involving short-term renters, according to a presentation shown to council. Some of the suggested changes for the policy presented to city council included requiring short-term rental owners to provide guests with a good neighbor brochure, requiring owners to give a termination notice when the unit is no longer a rental, requiring a contact person to be available to answer calls 24/7, and enacting a penalty for not registering. Council member Robert Griffin said Friendswood doesn't have enough short-term rentals to justify city staff investing time and resources in rolling out a stricter policy for rental owners. Council member Joe Mantranga said he spoke with a Galveston city council member who praised the benefits of registering short-term rentals since it made it easier for the city to regulate the rentals and protect against undesired outcomes, such as overcrowding in the rentals or not being able to reach the rental owner to flag violations. Betranga also said he was aware of short-term rental owners in other cities installing bunk bedrooms in the homes to hold up to 30 people in a four-bedroom house, adding that he wanted to prevent a similar scenario from playing out in Friendswood. Slated to break ground in February, Friendswood City Center could house the city's first hotel, according to city documents. Now, in a related story from December that provides more information about the development, city center that is, Friendswood City Center, 106-acre mixed-use development expected to break ground in 2024, this month as a matter of fact, and that is also from CommunityImpact.com. A 106-acre development with a hotel, retail, and other mixed-use buildings could be coming to Friendswood soon. Apparently, it will be. Tanos Development Group and Wolfgram Capital announced the creation of the new Friendswood City Center at a launch party on December 7th. Friendswood City Manager Morad Kabiri said the project is an opportunity to develop one of the most difficult properties in the city due to infrastructure deficiencies, drainage issues, and zoning restrictions. These issues have led to unsuccessful development attempts in the past. Tanos and Kabiri say the city currently lacks substantial recreational areas and amenities, resulting in residents seeking such facilities outside of Friendswood. The Friendswood City Center aims to retain income within the city instead of it flowing out to neighboring areas, as the developers claim the project will expect to bring in $700 million to the city. The Friendswood City Center will be at the corner of FM 528 and Bay Area Boulevard and will feature a range of components, including a luxury hotel, a 500-unit multifamily complex, retail spaces with 150,000 square feet, medical and office buildings with 200,000 square feet, mixed-use structures with condominiums with 225,000 square feet, entertainment areas, and also smaller pad sites. Approximately $60 million is earmarked for infrastructure development, including new roads and a 52-acre park with a 5.2-mile trail, a fully stocked fishing lake, waterfalls, wetlands, and more, Tanos said. After completion, Tanos said the park will be donated to the city. The groundbreaking was scheduled for January. I believe it took place or will shortly in February, with a projected total build-out time of 3 to 4 years, encompassing both infrastructure and vertical construction, Tanos said. Tanos said he envisions further development in the area, hoping to acquire additional commercial land and continuing to contribute to Friendswood's growth. Kabiri said the city recognizes the growing demand for multifamily units in Friendswood, highlighting the project's alignment with the area's needs and quality development standards. Kabiri outlined plans for 2024, including the construction of additional office buildings, restaurants, microbreweries, a hotel with a conference center, and more residential development in various locations around Friendswood. I'm not that familiar with the Friendswood area, so I can't judge whether this development is truly a community good or is just the kind of development that local movers, shakers, and politicians consider to be a community good. I can certainly see from how it's described that it would potentially be an economic and social benefit to the community in terms of additional jobs, housing, amenities, tax revenue, and infrastructure. I hope it works out well for all residents of Friendswood. Andrew?
Indeed. As for the short-term rental laws, I think Councilmember Griffin is wrong to want to wait to take action. If there didn't seem to be any reason to expect more of these rentals to pop up, then his position would be more understandable. But with a major tourist attraction being built in a nearby city, I think Friendswood would be wise to shore up their regulation of these rentals now rather than later.
I might also point out that the best time to take up the issue of short-term rentals is that there is not yet an invested constituency against it, so why wait until there is? Mm. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m., Thursdays at 6 p.m., and Sundays at 1 p.m. We are also on Google Podcasts, which can be downloaded from both the Android or iPhone app stores for the time being. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at Think Wing Radio, which is now the homepage. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type keywords into the search bar. Shows now are about 80% scripted, so you can usually scan episodes, or rather visually scan episodes, text to see if there's one particular topic in which you might be interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and look for me on Threads and Twitter at Think Wing Radio, plus Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. I'm at Dominate I on Twitter, Tumblr, and on YouTube, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's Dominate EYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube.
Our next story is from HoustonLanding.org. A major problem. Fort Bend ISD bond running $133 million over budget, drawing school board's ire. The $1.2 billion bond approved by Fort Bend Independent School District voters last May is already projected to run $133 million over budget, a predicament that shocked trustees who said Monday that they were kept in the dark about the shortfall for too long. District officials said multiple factors, including unexpectedly high construction cost inflation, labor shortages and internal leadership changes have weighed on Fort Bend's record-breaking bond, which voters approved by a roughly 2-to-1 margin last year. Fort Bend leaders planned to construct 2 new campuses, rebuild 3 aging schools, and spend about $600 million on upgrades at campuses throughout the district from the bond money. Dan Bankhead, Fort Bend's executive director of design and construction, said district leaders will try to find ways to cut project costs, such as using cheaper materials than originally planned. I'll touch on that later. The district ultimately could scale back its projects or attempt to pass another bond for more funding, though several trustees said they do not want to ask taxpayers for more money. The $1.2 billion bond marked the largest investment in school construction and renovations in the history of Fort Bend, which serves about 80,000 students and ranks as the Houston region's 4th largest district. At a school board meeting Monday, several trustees pressed district administrators about what caused the shortfall, who exactly bore responsibility for the errant initial projections, and the timeline for disclosing concerns about the bond budget. Deputy Superintendent Stephen Bassett said Fort Bend administrators received information about the wayward budget projections in September and could have adjusted the bond budget in November, but they didn't feel they had to, quote, pull the fire alarm. Now, there's some more finger pointing in the story, along with a table showing the original projections and the updated projections with cost overruns. The article goes on to say the bond budget shortfall ranks among the first major issues new Superintendent Mark Smith will confront after being selected by the board in December, just 2 weeks after Whitbeck's rocky exit. Smith, who previously served as Duncanville Independent School District Superintendent, did not speak at length about the projected shortfall on Monday. School districts traditionally outline projects and the expected cost for many bigger projects when asking voters to approve a school bond. The plans are typically developed alongside a committee of local residents. Fort Bend followed these practices last year. However, voters are not approving specific construction or spending plans when they cast their ballot for a school bond. Rather, they are merely authorizing the school district to issue bonds and in some cases raise the local property tax rate needed to raise the money for the projects. As a result, Fort Bend leaders could change or scale back their plans for the bond without needing voter approval. The district also could ask voters to authorize more financing for bond projects, though trustee Angie Hinnan said she is concerned about building trust with the public moving forward. Trustees asked district administrators Monday to give them monthly updates on the bond and its expected costs. Now, the first comment I have on this story, and I want to say this emphatically, the last thing that the trustees should do is opt for cheaper materials. Cheaper materials are just that. They'll not last as long. They may require more maintenance. They may even make construction or installation more difficult, which could increase labor costs. And you can be sure there will be unintended consequences. I'll share a maxim I created during my 20 years of window covering installation as part of what I modestly call Honig's Laws. It's this: the cheaper a product is, the harder it is to install until it's so cheap that it's practically uninstallable. A lot of homeowner products are like that. Especially in large projects, this becomes unacceptable to contract trade people, and they will charge more to get the job done. So cheaper materials will probably end up being a false economy. As for going over the bond issue budget, there certainly needs to be an investigation as to how that occurred and what can be done to prevent such errors in the future. I'm curious where the cost overruns are occurring. Are they in bids in which the bidder should be held to contract prices, or materials that can't be held to a fixed price as per the bids, perhaps? Kind of like a menu item that's listed as that day's market price. Perhaps the contracts needed to be written in such a way as to substantially protect the district from price changes. These are just some of the questions that might need answering. And of course, there's always some individual accountability that's going to have to be explored. Andrew?
Yes, that's all true. Though the district might retort, if we can't use cheaper materials, how are we supposed to keep to the budget? I would respond that the responsible thing to do here is to scale back the spending. Now, if I thought voters would go for another bond, I'd say do it. But this is Texas. Lots of voters here don't like the idea of government spending, even when lives are riding on it. I doubt a second oops bond would be very popular. When scaling back, I'd look to preserve proposals that seem the most direly needed, Rebuilding those aging schools, for example, sounds pretty important. District-wide upgrades certainly would be nice to have, but maybe some of them can be put off. Because cheapening out on the materials just sounds like the district will be spending more money on the same things down the road.
And I agree with Andrew. If Fort Bend adjusts to a slightly less ambitious plan now, without cheapening the materials, then they can go back for more bond money later, perhaps several years down the road after the initial bond money is mostly used up.
Hmm.
Okay, our next story is from click2houston.com, and this was news to me. Gates installed on Bissonnette Street in latest ongoing efforts to curb crime on infamous, not to me, I never heard of it, Southwest Houston Track. The Houston Police Department said strategically installed gates will be closed at night and reopened in the morning to prevent illegal activity on Bissonnette Street. The gates are the latest in the city's efforts to address crime issues in the area known as the Bissonnette Track. The so-called track is in the news consistently for its ties to prostitution, human trafficking, and more. In 2023, HPD began closing Plainfield Street and Center Parkway between Bissonnette and the Southwest Freeway every night. At the time the streets were closed, business owners in the area said having the police close certain streets reduced the amount of activity drastically. "I don't even see anyone on the street anymore," one business owner said at the time. Now, it's important to note that these closures do not block Bissonnette itself, at least not as I understand the story. I searched for what the closure hours are, and the best I could come up with was a Houston Landing story from June 2023 that I've linked to. That story said that HPD has closed Center Parkway and Plainfield Street to traffic nightly from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. Motorists wanting to get to Bissonnette Street from the Southwest Freeway or vice versa have had to find alternate routes. Now, I don't live in that area, nor do I visit very often, so this was the first I'd heard of it. Knowing what to expect if I have to pass through might be useful. You can see a map showing the streets that are closed in the Houston Landing story, or actually in a Houston Landing story, from January 22, 2024, that I've also linked to. And if you're interested, I suggest you click the story links I've provided to get more information. Andrew?
Stopping human trafficking, specifically, is certainly an admirable goal, and I'm glad that folks in the area feel safer, according to the Houston Landing story. But I can't help but feel that gating off entire streets after certain hours seems a little dystopian. I'm not sure I like the possible normalization of the police gating off any area they consider to have high enough crime. Besides, as a constable's office representative notes in the Landing story, some of this activity is just moving elsewhere in the city. It looks to me like these gates have been most effective at just sweeping the problem under the rug instead of actually solving it. I see the strategy of closing roads as part of a broader strategy of criminalizing sex work. One of the least directly harmful parts, sure, but a part nonetheless. If the point is to stop human trafficking via stopping sex work, the problem with that is that punishing sex work actually makes it harder to stop human trafficking, because sex workers who may become aware of harmful exploitation can't tell police about it for fear of being arrested themselves. Instead, I would suggest that city officials push for changes to federal and state law that would enable Houston to take a decriminalization approach to sex work, and thus allow those workers to help fight human trafficking as well as set up safely off of the street. This would have the same impact of making Bissonnette and the surrounding area a safer place, and would feel a lot less like Houston had its own personal Arkham City.
You might want to explain that witty reference for the uninitiated.
Ah, of course. It's from a Batman video game. Batman sends supervillains to the Arkham Asylum, which gets destroyed, so another supervillain convinces the city to wall off its old town as a mega asylum to replace it, and put him in charge. As part of his plot to quote-unquote end all crime, this guy fills Arkham City with weapons and starts sending every criminal he can there to kill each other, quickly followed by law-abiding folks who just don't like the idea. I think you can see why I made the connection.
Yeah, and it's funny how they always have super criminals who are power appropriate to the superheroes in a given city. I guess they must have a union.
Yeah.
Our next story is from KHOU.com. Investors meet at Houston Summit to discuss how to strengthen Texas's power grid. Potential investors from around the country with more than $2.2 trillion in assets attended the Texas Power Grid Investment Summit in Houston on Tuesday. State lawmakers recruited potential investors to find new natural gas, or rather to build new natural gas, because you can't find them, they don't just grow on trees, to build new natural gas plants to keep the Texas grid running during extreme weather. The state's grid operator, ERCOT, said its 10 highest energy demand records all set in August of 2023 during the second hottest summer on record in Texas history. While solar and wind energy helped the grid stay afloat during those days, lawmakers are concerned about extreme winter weather, like the February 2021 freeze that killed more than 200 people, because energy usage is typically highest at night when the sun's not shining. Ah, but the wind blows. Anyway, inside a conference room at the Houstonian Hotel on Tuesday morning, potential investors from around the country with more than $2.2 trillion in assets attended the summit. It's only $10 billion to transform the state of Texas to be the most resilient power source, to become the most resilient growth state in the U.S., said BlackRock CEO Larry Fink. BlackRock is a major investment management company. Fink invited potential investors to the Texas Grid Investment Summit after previously traveling to Texas twice to meet with Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. Fink had initially reached out after Patrick prioritized Senate Bill 13 in the 2021 legislative session, which placed BlackRock on a list of blacklisted companies deemed not friendly to fossil fuel. Patrick said Fink asserted his support for fossil fuels and willingness to do more, which sparked the idea for the conference. You know, all the people with the money, Patrick said while recalling their conversation, would you put together a conference and bring them all to Houston? Patrick believes natural gas plants haven't been built recently because of federal incentives for renewables. In November 2023, Texas voters approved a $10 billion low-interest loan program and other incentives to build new dispatchable power plants like natural gas after state lawmakers signed off first. KHOU 11 energy expert Ed Herz said Tuesday he doubts the recent incentives will be enough because ERCOT's market model hasn't changed to reward reliability. Herz said the owners of those plants won't get a return on investment. The gas plants are not being paid to be ready to come online. It's difficult to keep paying to keep that equipment operating, to keep the employees in place, when we know that year by year by year, they're going to be used less and less and less. Both Herz and Patrick said it'll take about 4 years to get a natural gas plant up and running. Applications for that new state low-interest loan program open in June. I had Ed Herz on the show some years back. He's a local expert on the fossil fuels industry. If he thinks there is not a profit to be made from this initiative, then he's likely correct. From memory, I'm going to point out that the plants that failed during the 2021 freeze were natural gas-fired plants that had not been properly weatherized. Also from memory, I'm going to point out that wind power from West Texas had gone largely wasted because there was not enough necessary infrastructure to bring that power to where it was desperately needed. Thirdly, I'm going to point out that if you were lucky enough to have electricity during the 2021 freeze without a contract to lock in prices, or if you had operational gas heat, you were socked with huge bills because the price of natural gas on the spot market had gone crazy. Texas Republicans are beholden to state fossil fuel interests, but if Texas Republicans really want to make the Texas electricity grid more resilient, I have three suggestions for them. One, develop infrastructure to bring wind power throughout the state. This will also make wind energy more profitable and will incentivize development of more of it. Two, stop incentivizing Bitcoin farmers to come to Texas and profit off of very low special pricing for electricity. This will create less stress on the grid and also allow more breathing space for power generators. And three, connect Texas to the North American grid. This will help prevent supply problems like in 2021 by shifting demand to places that have supplies, which will also prevent profiteering and price gouging that profits a few at the expense of the average Texan. I realize that this plan will put a hitch in the possibility of Texas secession, but, you know, them's the breaks. Andrew?
Agreed. And, of course, financial mercenaries like BlackRock would cozy up to people like Dan Patrick and the Texas Republican Party, who would never even think of standing in business's way, unless they could rile up their voter base and gain more power from it. I guess Republicans are mercenaries, too, in that way.
And that may be one of the more admirable qualities they have. Okay, this is ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org or listen anytime at archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media, and we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for ThinkWing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick ThinkWing Radio and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps, too, and it's free. Okay, Greg Abbott defends migrant tactics in Eagle Pass amid escalating legal battle with the Biden administration. This is from TexasTribune.org. Flanked by visiting Republican governors, Governor Greg Abbott on Sunday afternoon railed against President Joe Biden's handling of the southern border and recommitted to defending the state from an invasion of migrants, his word. Abbott has doubled down on enforcement at the border amid an escalating feud with the federal government over who controls part of the Texas-Mexico border in Eagle Pass, a town of about 29,000 residents. Although immigration law enforcement is under the jurisdiction of the federal government, Abbott claims the Biden administration has failed to enforce immigration law, leaving the state to fend for itself. Texas has continued to erect razor wire on a barrier between the Rio Grande River and Shelby Park, a 47-acre area in Eagle Pass, even after the federal government said the wire impedes federal border agents from apprehending people who cross the river. Abbott said gang members, as well as hundreds of people on the terrorist watch list, have been apprehended at the border. He thanked Border Patrol agents at checkpoints who have seized millions of lethal doses of fentanyl and thousands of pounds of methamphetamine. Republican governors have rallied behind Abbott's efforts to deter illegal immigration. Last month, 25 of them released a joint statement arguing that Texas has legal authority to defend itself because the Biden administration has failed to enforce immigration laws. About half of those Republican governors traveled to Shelby Park on Sunday, where they praised Abbott for his methods, such as building a border wall, installing wire, and placing a string of buoys in the river. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee and Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders said they would continue to deploy National Guard troops to the border to support Abbott. Lieutenant Colonel Freeman Martin, deputy director of DPS's Homeland Security Operations, told the visiting governor Sunday that Abbott's directives are working, according to a pool report from the Houston Chronicle. During a briefing at the DPS Eagle Pass area office, Martin said the razor wire and buoys save lives, his words. Martin's claim echoes previous assertions by DPS and Abbott that the buoys deter people from trying to cross, thus reducing drownings. The state has provided no evidence of that, however. Calls for DPS for more details weren't immediately returned by late Sunday afternoon. In January, a woman and two children drowned trying to cross the border at Eagle Pass, and Mexican authorities rescued two others. Federal officials accused the state of refusing to allow Border Patrol agents access to Shelby Park to assist in the rescue and recovery. State officials said Border Patrol requested access to the park after the drownings had already occurred. The standoff between Texas and the federal government began after the Texas National Guard and state troopers took control of Shelby Park in January, blocking Border Patrol agents from entering. Under federal law, the federal government has sole jurisdiction over the enforcement of immigration laws, a power upheld by multiple U.S. Supreme Court decisions. The Texas forces have deployed miles of concertina wire along the border at Eagle Pass, including around Shelby Park. When Border Patrol agents began cutting through the wire to apprehend migrants or reach those who needed medical attention, the state sued the federal government, accusing it of damaging state property. I'm okay with damaging that property. The Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a ruling in December that prohibited Border Patrol agents from cutting the wire, but on January 22nd, in a 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court vacated the lower court's ruling. The ruling did not explicitly grant Border Patrol agents access to the park or require the state to remove the concertina wire, prompting Abbott to double down. Shortly after, National Guard and state troopers began to block federal agents' entry to the park and deploy more concertina wire, as Abbott maintained his longstanding claim that the Biden administration has refused to enforce immigration laws. Another legal confrontation is brewing. Late last year, Abbott signed into law a bill that allows police to arrest people suspected of illegally crossing the Texas-Mexico border on state charges. Scheduled to take effect in March, the legislation prompted the American Civil Liberties Union and other groups to file lawsuits to overturn the law. In an interview with the New York Times published Friday, U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas called Abbott's actions on the border unconscionable, saying the state refused to communicate or coordinate with the federal government to create disorder. Abbott's visit to Eagle Pass coincided this weekend with the arrival of a convoy of Americans opposed to the Biden administration's handling of border policy. The Take Our Border Back convoy departed from outside Washington last week, passing through Dripping Springs along the way. Organizers called it a peaceful protest, though some critics expressed worry about violent or secessionist undertones. Border Patrol officials evacuated a migrant processing center in Eagle Pass Thursday after the FBI warned of threats to the facility. The convoy arrived Saturday in Camado, a rural community about 20 miles north of Eagle Pass. A rally attracted a modest crowd and remained peaceful, the New York Times reported. Attendees listened to Christian music, waved Trump 2024 flags, and called on the federal government to secure the U.S.-Mexico border. No intellectual cognizant deficiencies there. During the Sunday afternoon press conference, some members of the Take Our Border Back convoy faced off against Eagle Pass residents who condemned Abbott for spending billions of dollars on the border. Just outside of Shelby Park, convoy members held pro-Trump signs and chanted USA. Meanwhile, Eagle Pass residents and activists from other border towns, such as Laredo, led their own chants of Vive la Frontera. Some of those residents held a press conference before the governor's. Speakers criticized members of the convoy for hijacking Christianity. Others criticized Abbott for taking over a city park. "Quit wasting our tax dollars on political propaganda," said Juanita V. Martinez, an Eagle Pass resident and Maverick County Democratic Party chairperson. "Abbott doesn't care about anything but boosting his Republican political agenda." Now, in my opinion, by shipping illegal migrants and asylum seekers to northern cities, I have to admit Abbott has made his point by effectively lining up northern Democratic mayors to his side about the feds needing to do more to secure the border, but mainly to provide financial and logistical support to communities that simply are not equipped to handle this crush of people. Of course, it's essential to note that Abbott did this in the worst and cruelest of possible ways. He refused to give advance warning of migrants' arrivals at random points and at all hours of the day and night. Migrants arrived without proper clothing, often in freezing temperatures, with no one prepared to receive them. There was no chance to prepare food to greet them. No medical treatment was immediately available for those who might need it. Many of them were removed from the immigration courts they were scheduled to attend, making their necessary appearances very difficult, if not well-nigh impossible. As is so common in 21st century Republican posturing about illegal immigration, the cruelty was part of the point. How so-called self-described Christians can rationalize this kind of vindictive mercilessness as consistent with their New Testament scriptures is a constant puzzlement to me. Maybe they're going to the wrong Bible lessons. Andrew?
There's something bitterly funny about a group of people calling themselves the Take Our Border Back convoy, demonstrating against people who literally live on the border they're talking about. If the border belongs to anyone, it belongs to the people of Eagle Pass and every other community along it. This convoy from Washington has no claim.
Our next story is from nativenewsonline.net. A while back, Andrew introduced me to a newsletter called Native News Online, and I found it interesting enough to subscribe and ended up using it often enough that I send them a small monthly contribution. And today I have several stories I'd like to discuss. The first one is called Oglala Sioux Tribe Bans South Dakota Governor from the Pine Ridge Reservation. The Oglala Sioux Tribe has banned the South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, a Republican, from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation after the governor gave an incendiary speech about immigration to the South Dakota legislature last Wednesday. In the speech, Noem stated she wants to send razor wire and security personnel to Texas to stop immigration to the U.S.-Mexico border. She also stated that a gang allegedly tied to a cartel calling themselves the Ghost Dancers are bringing drugs onto the reservation. The banishment came Friday, and a four-page statement from Oglala Sioux Tribe President Frank Starr comes out. "Due to the safety of the Oyate people or nation in Sioux, effective immediately, you are hereby banished from the homelands of the Oglala Sioux Tribe," Tribe President Frank Starr comes out, said in a statement addressed on Friday to Noem. Starr comes out, accused the governor, an avid supporter of former President Donald Trump, of making the immigration problem a political issue to benefit the former president's chances of re-election. Starr comes out suggested Noam is vying to be Trump's vice presidential nominee. The Ogallala Sioux president says Noam is wrong about the immigrants seeking asylum in the United States when she said they needed to be put into cages. Starr comes out said many of the immigrants are indigenous Indians from places like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Mexico, who arrive at the southern border in search of jobs and a better life. He said they don't need to be put in cages, separated from their children like during the Trump administration, or be cut up by razor wire furnished by, of all places, South Dakota. The Oglala leader expressed his resentment on Noam's speech when she mentioned a gang calling themselves the Ghost Dancers is murdering people on the Pine Ridge Reservation and is affiliated with border crossing cartels that use South Dakota reservations to spread drugs to other parts of the country. He said, I and the Oyate are deeply offended that you allege that ghost dancers are affiliated with these cartels. Ghost dance, one of the most sacred ceremonies, was used with blatant disrespect and is insulting to our Oyate, Starr comes out wrote in his conclusion. Friday's banishment was not the first time the Oglala Sioux tribe told Noam she was not welcome on its reservation. The Noam administration has a history of maintaining a contentious relationship with South Dakota tribes. In May 2019, the Oglala Sioux Tribal Council unanimously voted to tell her she is unwelcome on the Pine Ridge Reservation until she rescinds her support for anti-protest legislation. Two additional Sioux tribes, Cheyenne River and Yankton, expressed their solidarity with the Oglala Sioux tribe. During the COVID-19 epidemic, Noam had a showdown with the Oglala Sioux tribe and Cheyenne River Sioux tribe when the two sovereign nations decided to close its reservations to non-natives. I've never personally known American Indians except in passing, so I can't say that I understand their rituals and culture. I don't have much that I'm qualified to add to this story, except to say that it's interesting how Native tribes are exerting their sovereignty in various situations, from politics to culture to technology. There will undoubtedly be times that there will be contention between Native and American policy differences, but it's good that we can now start to discuss these disagreements openly and hopefully with some degree of reasonable compromise. I will note that if you go to the map I've linked to and references below this story in my post, you'll see that if all the South Dakota tribes joined in this band, it includes a lot of South Dakota. Also at the link is an interactive travel guide to tribal lands that you can peruse. Visits to South Dakota tribal lands are welcome, and pages 10 and 11 of the brochure offer tips on etiquette when visiting tribal lands. Andrew?
I would quite enjoy seeing all tribes with territory overlapping South Dakota join in this ban. Imagine Kristi Noem losing access to about a third of the state. Unfortunately, I have to wonder if this ban could actually stand in court. I want it to, but the U.S. doesn't exactly have a great track record with respecting tribal boundaries in any sense of the word. If it did stand, though, that might open some very interesting possibilities for tribal law.
You're listening to Thinkwing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m., Thursdays at 6 p.m., and Sundays at 1 p.m. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for episodes of this show and over 100 other KPFT programs. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at Thinkwing Radio, which is now the homepage. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1, and you may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Just ask. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Thinkwing Radio with Mike Honig, and I'm on Threads and Twitter at Thinkwing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
Indeed I do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on YouTube, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and YouTube.
Our next story is also from NativeNewsOnline.net. Nebraska tribes and Native voters come out on top in redistricting lawsuit. Two tribes in Nebraska last week successfully negotiated a court-approved redistricting program with Thurston County to settle a lawsuit in which the tribes alleged that the county intentionally diluted the impact of Native voters. On January 26th, The U.S. District Court of the District of Nebraska approved a consent decree that requires the Nebraska County to adopt a new district plan to provide Native Americans a fair opportunity to elect candidates to the Thurston County Board of Supervisors. Local elections will use the new map starting in next year's elections. That would be 2025, I guess, and until the next redistricting process begins after 2030. As a result of historical participation in the 2020 census, the Native population in the United States grew by an astonishing 86.5%. According to census data in 2021, Thurston County had a population of 6,800, 60% of which is Native American. The majority of those Native residents are of voting age. The new map makes it so four of the seven Board of Supervisors districts will provide Native voters with a fair opportunity to elect their preferred candidates as required by the Federal Voting Rights Act, or VRA. This case marks the third time Thurston County has been successfully sued under the VRA for a redistricting plan that violates the rights of Native American voters in the county. Native people in Thurston County have thrived against all odds in spite of any setback, and this includes defending Native voters' right to participate in legal and fair elections in Nebraska, said Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska Chairwoman Victoria Kitchian in a statement. We negotiated the new district map with county officials so Native voters will have a fair chance at electing candidates to the Board of Supervisors in 2024, so I stand corrected. In 1979, courts subjected Thurston County to a consent decree forbidding the adoption of an at-large voting system as violating Section 2 of the VRA because an at-large system would disenfranchise the estimated 28% population of Native voters in the county at that time. As a result of another lawsuit, the courts in 1996 required Thurston County to create a legal district map that fairly apportioned the then estimated 36% of the population of Native voters per the VRA. The 2023 consent decree requires Thurston County to create a legal district map that reflects that Native Americans now comprise almost 60% of the county's population and make up a majority of the voting age population of Thurston County. During Thurston County's redistricting process after the release of the 2020 census, the Board of Supervisors refused to implement a VRA-compliant map proposed by both tribes and instead adopted a map that will now be replaced by a VRA-compliant map as required under the new consent decree. Native American voters continue to face historical disenfranchisement in many states and districts. Polling places located far from remote tribal communities and voter ID laws that prevent citizens living on reservations without traditional street addresses from voting have contributed to Native Americans having the lowest voter turnout of all groups. Mobilization efforts by Native-led organizations are changing that, however, and Native American voters increasingly play a major role in local and federal elections, according to a new report by the National Urban Indian Family Coalition. In 2002, South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson, a Democrat, was reelected by 500 votes when the final votes were counted on the Pine Ridge Reservation, according to an investigation by the Native American Rights Fund. Michigan had one of the closest margins in the 2016 presidential election with a margin of 0.3%. With more than 100,000 Native people aged 18 and older in Michigan, the number of Native people eligible to vote was four times more than the margin of victory in the state, according to the investigation. Andrew?
This is great news. In a state like Texas, where racist election maps are almost the default, and it's a coin flip whether a court will actually strike one down, one can forget that there are people fighting this kind of voter suppression and winning. A county that's majority Native is interesting as well. Hopefully, the elected supervisors will reflect the population they serve after next year's election.
It's worth noting that, legally speaking, Texas is not in much danger of these kinds of lawsuits from Native Americans. There are only about 4,700 acres of Native lands, and they are widely separated into three reservations. The Alabama Coushatta tribes of Texas have the lion's share of that land at 4,500 acres in East Texas. Hmm. According to the Texas Politics Project, where in Texas are indigenous groups, unlike most western states, Texas today has almost no Indian lands, the result of systematic warfare by Texas and the United States against indigenous groups in the 19th century that decimated tribes or drove them onto reservations in other states. While the limited number and size of Indian reservations in Texas today reveal much about relations between European-descended settlers and Indians at the turn of the 19th century, these reservations account for only a small percentage of the Native Americans in the state. Though only about 2,624 people have formally enrolled as members of Texas tribes, the 2000 census counted 118,362 people in Texas who identify themselves as exclusively American Indian or Alaska Native. Hmm. Our next story, also from Native News Online. Oklahoma Supreme Court hears case to determine if tribal members will pay state taxes. This week, the Oklahoma Supreme Court heard opening arguments, or rather this was at the end of January, heard opening arguments in a case that will determine whether or not tribal members are required to pay state income taxes. In 2020, Muscogee Creek Nation's enrolled tribal member Alicia Strobel filed for an income tax refund for the previous 3 years based on the fact that she lived within her tribe's reservation and was employed by the tribe. 2 years later, a judge for the Oklahoma Tax Commission ruled in Strobel's favor, but the Tax Commission rejected the decision and Strobel appealed. The Tax Commission argued Strobel doesn't live on reservation land, but on private land within reservation boundaries owned by an individual and is therefore ineligible for any state income exemption. Three Oklahoma tribes, the Cherokee Nation, Chickasaw Nation, and Choctaw Nation, filed a joint brief in support of Strobel, contending that collecting income taxes from tribe members employed by their tribe amounts to a sovereignty issue that contradicts established law. The tribe cited legal precedent established by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1993, where the court held that a state may not tax the income of a tribal member who lives and works in her tribe's Indian country. The nation's sovereignty is threatened because if the state has the power to convert reservation economic activity into state tax dollars, it will negate the rights of reservation Indians to make their own laws and be ruled by them, and jeopardize each nation's ability to operate programs and services that benefit the members, their members, and the state, the brief says. Oklahoma Governor Stitt, an enrolled Cherokee citizen, posted a video on X stating his goal is to ensure fairness across the board. If the Supreme Court rules that one race doesn't have to pay taxes, then no one should, he said. It's that simple. Tribal leaders disagree and point to the broader implications that hang in the balance of the legal challenge. The dispute raises broader questions regarding the interpretation of tribal sovereignty law, federal law, and the tax obligations of tribal citizens within Indian country, said Muscogee Creek Nation Principal Chief David W. Hill in a statement, all of which hold great significance in relation to Indian country's autonomy. Now, this will be interesting because if tribes are allowed to set their own taxation policies without worrying about double taxation by the state, this could make a big difference on reservations, whether the money is left in the hands of individuals or taxed for tribal infrastructure and social needs, or maybe a balance of both. And then there's the issue of fairness. If tribe members are sending money to Oklahoma City, but they're getting it, are they getting at least the value of those taxes back in tribal benefits? I mean, I hate to assume, but I suspect not. And while this story doesn't mention it, if this case succeeds, I wonder how this will end up eventually impacting collection and distribution of sales taxes, permit fees, etc. One way or another, this case could end up setting an important and broadly accessible precedent for Oklahoma and perhaps other tribes across the United States, of which Texas is still one. Andrew?
Indeed. I want to explicitly counter Governor Stitt's ridiculous assertion that this case is about race, though. It isn't. It's about sovereignty. Tribal nations are given roughly equal status as states under federal law. A U.S. state collecting state taxes from people living and working on federally recognized native land would be like Texas collecting taxes from people in eastern New Mexico because they live on land that Texas used to claim. Just because one state-level government claims or had claimed land that belongs to another state-level government doesn't give the first government the right to tax it. Surely conservatives can understand that.
Well, you know, Texas wants to regulate people traveling out of state for abortions and health care. So, you know, in Texas, anything is possible. Or, as Calvera noted in The Magnificent Seven, in Texas, only Texans can rob banks. Our last story is from APnews.com. Orbán's party boycotts a session of Hungary's parliament to further stall Sweden's bid to join NATO. Lawmakers from the party of Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban boycotted an emergency session of parliament on Monday, where a vote was scheduled to place Sweden's bid to join NATO on the legislative agenda, adding to 18 months of delays that have angered Hungary's allies. The governing Fidesz party, which holds an absolute majority in parliament, has stalled Sweden's bid since July of 2022, alleging that Swedish politicians have told blatant lies about the condition of Hungary's democracy. After Turkey's parliament voted to approve Sweden's accession in January, Hungary became the last of the military alliance's 31 members not to have done so, leading its allies to pressure the nationalist government to hold a vote without delay. Orban told NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg last month that he would urge his party to ratify the bid at the first possible opportunity. Monday's session in parliament was supported by six opposition parties, but Fidesz lawmakers didn't attend, scuttling the attempt to place a vote on the legislature's schedule. Several ambassadors from NATO member countries attended the proceedings, including U.S. Ambassador David Pressman. In brief comments to the media following the session, Pressman said the United States looks forward to watching this closely and to Hungary acting expeditiously. Sweden's NATO accession is an issue which directly affects the United States' national security and affects the security of our alliance as a whole, he said. The prime minister pledged to convene parliament to urge parliament to act at its earliest opportunity. Today was an opportunity to do that. A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers last week called on Orban to immediately ratify Sweden's bid, saying patience with Hungary is wearing thin as it continues to delay its approval. In a separate statement, U.S. Senator Ben Cardin, a Maryland Democrat and chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, raised the prospect of imposing sanctions on Hungary for its conduct and called Orban the least reliable member of NATO. Following the session on Monday, Agnes Vidai, a lawmaker with the Liberal Democratic Coalition Party, said that Orban's conduct has, quote, put Hungary into a very humiliating position and that there was no reason for his government to have blocked Sweden's NATO membership. I think it's very personal for Orban, and it's also very irrational what he's doing despite all the pressure that's coming, she told the AP. He himself should understand that Sweden's membership is going to serve the interests and the security of Hungarian society. Hungarian officials have indicated that Fidesz lawmakers won't support holding a vote until Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson accepts an invitation by Orban to visit Budapest to negotiate on the matter. Kristersson has said that he will make the trip, but only after Hungary approves his country's NATO membership. Fidesz, in a statement on Monday that ratification of Sweden's NATO accession can take place during a regular session of parliament, but we are expecting the Swedish Prime Minister to visit Hungary first. The party said, if this is an important issue for the Swedes, the Swedish prime minister will obviously come to Budapest. Hungary's parliament is scheduled to reconvene on February 26th, but Vidai, the lawmaker, said there was no guarantee that Orban's party would commit to a swift approval. I'm not sure whether the opening session will start with the Swedish ratification, unfortunately, she said.
Well, we have some pretty extensive comments on this story, but we just don't have time to get to them. So please head to the blog post at thinkwingradio.com to read those, because we go somewhere rather interesting, if I do say so myself.
And you've been listening to Thinkwing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. My co-host, indispensable editor, and assistant producer is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting and look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the store. Why don't we cross the bridge together?
At KPFT, our listeners are very important to us. Here's what they say about us.
I was out at an event at Discovery Green, and a homeless person came, and he said he needed to hear KPFT. And the only way he could hear it was on a transistor radio. And he only had $10, and he gave me the $10. And I told him, oh, you don't have to do that. And he said, yes, I do. I need to support this station. You're telling people what they need to hear. And you are affecting people's lives, because I repeat what you guys have to say to other people, even right-wingers. And eventually, sometimes have an effect on them, and they'll come back later on and tell me what effect I had from learning from you guys and from other things. But just keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much for listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Laura, inviting you to join me for the Laura Flanders Show, which airs Monday mornings at 9 a.m. right here on Community Radio KPFT 90.1 FM. The news got you down? Every week we bring you information that just may lift your spirits. In-depth conversations about change and change-making with people who are doing it in the worlds of arts, politics, and economics. You get my two cents on the issues, too, with every episode. We lift up tomorrow's heroes today and talk about how we can move together to a better future for all. That's the Laura Flanders Show, the place where, as we like to say, the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Join me Monday mornings at 9 a.m. here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston.